Give me a mic check for Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, hello, check one Tampa, check two Tampa. I need some more on one.
Okay.
Casino, check, check. Hard Rock, Tampa, check, check. Seminole Hard Rock.
Check it out for yourself at SeminoleHardRock.com. All right, guys, I'm rolling. Let's kick it.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me today is Peter Garrett, lead singer and frontman in the Australian band Midnight Oil, active initially from 1972 to 2002, and again since 2016. Their latest album, Resist, came out this past February, and since then they've embarked on their final worldwide tour. Their tune, Undercover, was written by Peter, and it's a recent coolest song in the world. We'll hear a portion of that now, followed by our chat together on your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock. In Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Drive a barrel rolling autumn. The jib's on fire like a red plum. The burning colors beat the humdrum. As time goes by, I try to hold the vision slippery. The air is thickening in front of me. The scented garments are sweet sanctuary. As time goes by, oh yeah, I still got a clear eye, bathed in soft sunlight. I'm feeling the magic of the day.
Mighty Manfred here with you in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. And my guest today for our coolest conversations is musician, environmentalist, activist, and former politician Peter Garrett, best known as the lead singer in the Australian band Midnight Oil, who over the course of their career have scored dozens of hits down under and all over the world. Earlier this year, the band released their 13th studio album, Resist, which features our coolest song in the world this week, Undercover. Hey, Peter, how are you?
Hey, Manfred, I'm happy to be talking to you.
I am very honored to be chatting with you, man. You know, this the new album, Resist, came out in February. You've been touring all over the world and support of it. There's still dates to happen. How are you feeling so far about the album's reception and the audiences that you've played to?
Well, you know, it's a very Midnight Oil record, Manfred. It's direct, it's political. It probably sounds pretty left-wing, particularly to maybe American audiences. And it's certainly not, you know, going to be a chart topper necessarily, but it's a very strong record with songs that we believe in. And I think, as we've always done in the past, we just have to go out and play to people, which we're doing really for the big last time round. And audiences in Australia, we call them punters, but the punters have been coming and they've been with us for the full 2 hours or 2.5 hours. So it's actually been a really lovely thing for us to be able to do. We feel very privileged to be still making music at this point, saying what we mean, saying what we think, and having people come and listen to us.
Well, you were a long way from those days as The Farm when you first joined up with band members Rob Hurst, the drummer, and Jim Magini, the guitar player. My understanding is that you answered an ad to join those guys. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually a lawyer, not by training, but by my academic background is a legal politics background. But I love singing in bands. I was singing in a university band, like a college band. I came back up to Sydney where my mum was living, and I was going to work as a labourer in the summer, you know, just laying bricks in a building site or something. And I saw the ad. I thought, well, why not? I'll go down. I've been singing in the college, at my college, so all I can do is go down and do it. And I went down and met them. They were younger than me. They were in their last year of school. Mm-hmm. But there was just something about the way they played, just the power of it and the inventiveness of the playing. And even though I went back to Canberra and they went off to try and find some other singers, they never did, of course. And I came back and the rest is history.
So when you joined the band, did you ever in your wildest dreams think that, well, 50 years on, I'll be touring the world again with these guys?
In no way at all, Manfred. And for anyone listening, whether they're in their teens or their 60s or in between or whatever, I think we all know when we take a bit of a breath and look at our lives, it goes incredibly quickly. And, I mean, look, we've put in the time on the buses, you know, up and down your east and west coast. We put in a lot of time in the early days in the clubs and the pubs. We were sort of a punk new wave band, but with more than three chords in some ways. And I think all I really wanted to do was just see if we could do it, you know, make a living from it. And maybe we'd make a record and I could take it home and, you know, play it to my gran and she could put it on the mantelpiece, you know, along with the family photos, and then that would be the end of it.
So you mentioned, you know, being looking for, I guess, a summer work job, and you mentioned your mom. And now both your mother and your father had passed away by the time the band was really getting underway. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, do you have any siblings?
Yeah, I'm the eldest of three boys. So I'm the eldest brother. And my two younger brothers used to spend time roading for us in the early days. They still show up and sit out the back and, you know, critique the sound when they're in town.
That's always very helpful, isn't it? Supportive.
Yeah, well, you need someone to tell you the truth.
Well, right. So what was family life like? Were you encouraged to pursue music to any extent, or was music more like a refuge for you?
Well, I grew up in a household where there was a lot of music played, and my parents both had pretty broad tastes, I realized looking back on it. You know, gramophone records had just arrived, and Australia, we were following pretty much what was happening overseas. So, you know, they would be listening to Duke Ellington, Sinatra, Elvis Presley, you know, then the Beatles probably, and maybe some jazzier things, which I didn't really discover at the time, like Gershwin, for example.
Right.
But I was sang in choirs, church choirs, when I was a kid, which is pretty unusual in Australia because it's not a very religious country and choirs are not that common anyway. But I just love to sing, and that's where I started. And eventually I sort of found my way into, you know, make-believe folk clubs around the Peter, Paul and Mary, Simon and Garfunkel era.
Yeah.
Where, again, in Australia, we were probably just pretty much copying what we were hearing or early Dylan. But I wasn't very confident at it. When I went to uni, I actually worked my way through uni, a bit like Elvis, by driving trucks. Okay. And so I used to drive, I drove trucks on the weekends, and then I actually took a year off and drove trucks around the place delivering heating oil and whatever. And a band asked me, would I come and drive their gear around on the weekend if they rented a truck? And I said, yeah, I'm really happy to. And I heard them play and they were okay, but the singer was definitely a little below the game. Yeah. Of course, I said that and they said, well, you know, you think you can do better? And I said, yeah, I think I probably can. So I had been singing a little bit in like a uni band. And when I say
we go... for a second, because I want to understand. So when you say uni, you're talking about university? What do you mean?
Yeah, correct.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So we would pack up our gear into a small post office van, essentially.
Yeah.
And this is in the equivalent of your DC. This was in Canberra in Australia,
yeah.
But much smaller, like way smaller. And we'd play in pubs sometimes on the weekends. We'd play to students occasionally. We'd go out and play to farmers, you know, in their sort of annual dance, and we go and play to rural communities. I wouldn't call them redneck communities, but certainly conservative communities. Anyway, it's a great way to learn. It's like how we all learn, you know.
Right.
But when I went to Sydney, we weren't that good, is the truth of it, Manfred. And when I went to Sydney and answered the ad in the paper for the oils that Rob Hurst had put in the Sydney Morning Herald, it's like putting an ad in the New York Times, you know.
Right.
You know, drummer wanted, you know, singer wanted, you know, whatever. I heard something pretty special. And eventually I did move back from Canberra to Sydney. I finished my degree. The rest of the band did the same thing. And then we decided we'd just go full time and see if we could survive just by making music.
So they started off, you guys started off as The Farm, and then 76, you changed name to Midnight Oil. And the story I've read is that you drew names out of a hat. Do you recall what the other options were?
Yeah, I do actually. Interestingly, one of them was television. and I think Tom Verlaine probably had formed television, but only just. We certainly didn't know about it. Another one was Sparta, S-P-A-R-T-A, you know, from back in the days when the Greeks and the Spartans and what have you were all fighting one another. Another one was called Southern Cross, which is the star aggregation of stars in the southern sky, which is very beautiful. A lot of Australians, myself included, think that we should have at least part of the Southern Cross on our flag instead of the English Union Jack.
Yeah.
But I can't remember the other ones. But anyway, as you say, Midnight Oil comes out of the hat. And even if you don't really like the name straight away, the great thing about a band name is that you turn it into something every time you make a performance or you record a song.
Well, who actually contributed the name Midnight Oil? Do you recall?
Actually, it was someone who was in the band and then got chucked out. Anyway, that's life.
Well, have you ever seen them since? And have they ever said, you know, you are Midnight Oil only because of me?
Well, you know what? We have seen him since, and he's a little bit more generous in nature, and I think just quite proud of the fact that he'd made the call on the name.
Well, so when you changed the name, did the music in the band actually change with it? I mean, was it different going forward as Midnight Oil as opposed to Farm or The Farm?
Yes, it did change when we became Midnight Oil in a way. I think that I often say to people, one way of understanding Australian music is to take all of the different influences that you're receiving. Obviously, it's the stuff you grew up with, the bands that you're listening to at the time, whether they were local bands or overseas bands. In our case, American bands, English bands, and then Australian bands that people would know, like maybe AC/DC or the Easy Beats.
Yeah.
And then you add a little bit of what you've got. But Farm was essentially a much freer jamming sort of band. It was playing all kinds of different cover songs. The boys were starting to write a bit, so there were a few songs around. When we became Midnight Oil, that was really when punk hit. There was an Australian band called The Saints. Some of your listeners might know them. They recorded a fantastic song.
Yeah, we play a lot of The Saints here in the
Underground. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And a really seminal band. I mean, they recorded I'm Stranded before Sex Pistols recorded Anarchy in the UK, you know.
Right.
God Save the Queen or whatever it was. So we had those influences really starting to hit. The Ramones, I think, Iggy, to some extent, New York Dolls a bit later on, were quite a presence in a scene which we were not in the middle of, but we were aware of it. We were aware of that energy, the do-it-yourself ethic,
right?
You know, cutting to the chase, writing simpler songs and playing them furiously really appealed to us, and that's pretty much what Midnight Oil started doing, even though occasionally we'd go off on a wander.
So I was wondering about that. Do you describe yourself at the time, I think you touched on this, as sort of a punk new wave band, or did you consider yourselves a punk band at all?
I don't think a punk band, because we're not anarchists, you know. And punk seemed so English, you know. It was just too English for us, really. And also, I never really trusted Malcolm McLaren, you know. I always thought he was a bit of a poser, and they were just trying to sell T-shirts, you know.
Yeah.
But we did like the ethic, you know. Like the one great thing for me about punk, apart from saying what it thinks, was that it put on its own shows. It made its own records. It made its own clothes. You know, all you needed was, you know, a room somewhere, and you'd set up, and a pressing plant. Someone would press some singles for you, and you'd throw the posters up. And I mean, there was something about that scene which was actually fantastic. And I think that ethic stayed with us for a long time, but musically, no, we were quite a long way from punk. A bit new wavy, but you know, we could play probably better than that.
Well, did you have any relationship with other Australian kind of punk related bands that were active as you were around this time, around 78, like Radio Birdman, or were you guys sort of your own thing?
Yeah, no, not really. I mean, we've come to know some of the Radio Birdman guys much better. I mean, Jim Genie and Rob Young are quite, see one another quite a bit nowadays, but back in the day, we were on the other side of the harbour.
Yeah.
And even though we came into the sort of inner city, the grungy part of town to play, we made a decision pretty quickly that we wanted to play where the people were, and mm-hmm. most of those young Australian kids were in suburbs, really, outside the city, up and down the coast, in like beer barns, big bars, things like that. So even though we knew those people and occasionally we interacted with them, and I saw Birdman very early on when they played, they had their own venue in town in Sydney called mm-hmm. the Oxford Funhouse, and it was sensational. I mean, they went right to the wire and beyond, and it had an impact on me because it made me realize that we could play harder, you know, and faster, and it would be okay. But we were pretty much our own beast at that point in time.
Well, I want to ask you about this this manager, Gary Morris. You know, Elvis had his Colonel Tom, Beatles had Brian Epstein. This manager, Gary Morris, how important was he to your success as you were starting off?
I think he was pretty important. It's quite a generous comparison that you've run at him, Manfred, but you're not far off the scent though, because he was meteoric. He was quite imaginative. He didn't mind taking on the business head on for us. And he took the politics thing that, you know, clearly we really wanted to do and I was very focused on. He didn't necessarily always agree with it, but he was happy that we should lead with that. And he was mad and like a bull at a gate, you know. So and you need to have someone like that, I think, particularly for a band like ourselves, because we had the sort of attitude of punk, but with the constructivism of wanting to build a big relationship with our audience and a body of work which was saying something.
Yeah.
And we didn't want it to be polluted or affected or broken down in any way. And so we had our own label with a sort of a television channel sort of record company thing, which they just let us do whatever we wanted. When eventually we came across to the Forces of Darkness, because it's just too much work running your own record company, as lots of people know.
Yeah.
We made sure we kept all our control over it. So Gary was a bulldog in that respect. And he was also quite, you know, he'd come up with the wildest ideas on earth. I mean, he was a handful, and over time it just became too much. But I think he was
pretty important. What was one of these wild ideas that he had come up with?
Well, one time we wanted to control everything and run our own shows,
right.
Including setting the price of the show. And like everywhere else in the world, venues were run by managers and promoters and bookers and so on.
Right.
And in our venue that we were playing a lot on the beach, we got to the point very early on and I stood up and I said, look, we're losing this argument at the moment. We want to set the prices here. We don't want to charge everybody too much. We're not going to play anymore, and just walked off. But then, of course, we were stuck, you know, because we'd sort of missed the shows for the night. Now, we're talking about 77, 78 here, a little tamer time than now, even though punk was around. One of the things that Gary came up with was putting our own shows on in town halls around the place, and he just simply called them Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll and Midnight Oil, you know. Other ideas that he had related to us essentially filming us doing everything leading up to making the song, the development of the song, seeing the entrails of the band as we did it, just essentially just running the tape. Go and play for 10 weeks and we'll have that as a teaser for us. Some of his other ideas were very far-fetched, and now that you've asked me, I might be able to think of another one in a second, and if I do, I'll jump in.
Oh, sure. Well, so you said, like Gary, even though he may not have agreed necessarily with the some of the activism that the band was for, he went with that. And I was wondering, did that cause, outside of Gary, caused a lot of difficulty with music industry types as you were starting out your political and environmental activism?
No, 100%. Midnighter wasn't, we were a popular band on the street for the first 5 to 8 years of our career, but we certainly weren't popular with the industry and we weren't really prominent in the mainstream at all. They either didn't like us or they didn't understand us.
Yeah.
One or the other. And Australia, which we love dearly, has got quite the business was very focused, like it still is in some ways, which is very focused on, chart success and getting songs on radio in those days and so on. And a lot of people didn't rate me at all as a singer. They thought it was just a weird act, and they didn't really like the voice. And we were, sometimes the songs would go for 7 minutes, sometimes they'd go for 3 minutes, sometimes they sounded like punk songs, sometimes they sounded like, the Eagles have sped up. They couldn't really label us, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's interesting chatting to you now because I think that for most artists that stay the distance, if you like, or believe in what they're doing, they really don't have to take in all the white noise that's coming at them from everywhere else.
Yeah.
In a way, our masterstroke, if you want to call it that, was just basically maintaining a connection with an audience that kept us alive when the industry was ignoring us. And we were in debt forever and a day. The first time we came to the States, first time we went and recorded in London and so on and so forth, we were always carrying debt, but we could always come back and pay it off by going and doing, 10 weeks in the pub. So we kept the connection with the audience. It took the industry probably about a decade to figure us out and then decide whether they liked us or not.
Well, the new album Resist keeps your activism in the forefront, especially environmental activism. You recorded it in late 2019, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So how does this release tie into the Macarata project? Because some of those songs are from the same session, recording sessions.
Yeah, right. So we did the big tour in 2017. I mean, I had nearly 14 years away from the band. I had 4 years as the ACF president, like a big, like the Sierra Club, I guess, in Australia. Yeah. And then of course, I was a member of parliament. And then I was in the government. Then I was a cabinet minister. So that certainly took me off in a direction where there wasn't much space or time for thinking about music.
Yeah.
But when I did come back and when we did decide to go and play, we really didn't know whether people would come out to listen to the band. And I think by the time we finished that big tour in 2017, 2018, then the next obvious question was, well, there were people there. Have we got any songs? And in that period of time, of course, with so many strong songwriters in the band, there were plenty of songs that tipped out. So we basically recorded them all in one hit. Of those songs, probably half a dozen or more had such a strong theme for our Indigenous people in Australia, Aboriginal people, First Nations people. And both lyrically and in some ways a bit musically as well, we realised that 20 years ago we might have just sung them, but in this day and age, for those songs to have any real authenticity, we needed to invite Aboriginal people, musicians and performers in to contribute to those songs and to sing them and maybe to do some co-writing, which we'd never done before. We haven't got always people in the studio coming. We've got enough to handle with just four or five of us, but anyway, we were able to do that. And so the first bunch of those songs, which certainly featured quite well-known but also up-and-coming Aboriginal musicians, was called the Macarata Project. And we released that earlier. Of course, COVID got in the middle of all of this, as we all know.
Right.
And then Resist was the songs, not that we had left over, but that was the next bundle of songs, which then became the work that you now hear on that record.
And so before the Macarata Project, your last studio full length was 2002's Capricornia.
Yeah.
And then came the career that you were describing in the interim. So the songs on Resist, do any date that far back, or were they all fairly recent compositions of 2019? You mentioned coming off the tour, and then what songs do we have? But were any of the songs on Resist written earlier, or were they all fairly recent compositions?
I think some of them were written earlier, including Macarada. There were some, I mean, Bonesy Hillman, our dear bass player, who passed away literally almost when we finished recording. He had terrible cancer and passed away in the States. He lived in Wisconsin, but he and I had run up a song, I don't know, 15 years ago, which, you know, for whatever reason, just didn't end up any on a record. That came up on Macarada. I think a couple of Jim's, especially some of the musical beds he'd had lying around forever and a day. It was a little, it varies for all of us, you know. People were pulling ideas out as they went, but also drawing on stuff that had been sitting in their back pocket or just hadn't found a place. And I think the writing and recording process this time round was much more organic than it had been for years, because we just simply had such a lot of ideas and such a lot of songs wherever or however they had been written. They just came in and we found it relatively easy just to sort of lock into them and just get them down.
Well, you mentioned Bones, and that was my next question for you. So he passed away, as you said, just after finished recording. You'd had members of the band leave before, but his passing is the only death of a band member that was current in the lineup. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. How close were you guys?
Pretty close. I think, I mean, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because a lot of, I mean, I'm not comparing us to bands like this necessarily, but if you look at bands that have been around for a long, long time, or even bands that we know very well, maybe who've been very successful or big bands, it's very rare that they haven't had all sorts of conflicts and arguments, and stuff has been public and personality clashes. Yeah. Quite often that's because, you know, I mean, you look at the Beatles, they were battling it out, but they were in their 20s, you know, writing this incredible music. And I think to last longer, if you talk to musicians that have lasted longer than that, the main thing that they have to do is they've got to respect one another's musical contributions, and then it becomes a little bit more like a family than it does like a friendship.
Yeah.
So I see Bonesy really as a brother. He was more like my little brother. He was the guy that was, you know, he was the wisecrack guy from New Zealand who, you know, never saw a lettuce leaf that he hated and never saw a bar that he wasn't in love with, you know. a very strong player, but a wonderful singer and a great presence in the band. I mean, he was the young one in the band. He'd been in the band for over 16 years.
Right. He joined about 1987. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So it's, you know, long time, maybe even longer than that. But so, yeah, of course, you're spending a lot of time with someone in a band, particularly from Australia, because we got to fly for 13 hours before we get there. And then once we get there, you can't go back home and, you know, see your partner or your girlfriend or your wife or whatever. You really are kind of glued to one another in the bus or in the van or in the hotel. So you develop a relationship which is pretty enduring. And even though we suspected something wasn't quite right, and we knew he wasn't very healthy, he played so well on the record and sang so well that when he actually did, and he wanted to come back to where he'd been living in the States, and he said, oh, I want to go back, I want to see my dog, I want to spend some time with my ex. And then, you know, within like a month, he was gone.
Wow. Our coolest song in the world this week is Undercover, and this is a tune that you wrote. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And I guess you were saying that for this album, the writing process was more organic than usual. So in the past, was it people coming up with demos of tunes and sketches and presenting them to other members? And specifically in this case, how was the song coming together or came together?
Yeah, look, I don't think there's ever been any sort of set formula for us with writing. It depends a little bit on what's going on in our lives and in the life of the band, but certainly over the years, Jim Magini in particular would pretty much go and record demos of his songs or his ideas.
Yeah.
And bring them forward. Sometimes they were sketches, sometimes they're much more fully fledged. Rob tends to bring in the ideas and the song and the architecture of it, although not necessarily recorded. And I tend just to bring in something and see where it ends up. They're very strong songwriters and a lot more prolific than I am. But I think that this time round, the songs just simply tumbled out onto the table, you know. Mm-hmm. We did do some demos just to pull them up, just so we could have a bit of a listen to see whether they, you know, were able to float on the water or whether they were sinking or sort of getting carried away. It's not really about the technical aspect of the song for Minotto, because technically or musically, you know, we love playing music in a way which is strong and fierce, but after all this time we can play that sort of music in a way with our eyes closed. What you're really looking for is something else, which is it pure? Is it instinctive? Is it strong? Is it coming from the heart? Does it make sense as that this funny old weird thing called a rock song? You know, is it going to make sense? And you pretty much know straight away with those songs, and then you also pretty much know how you want to treat them. So they just came tumbling out. Jim says, you know, he heard a few of the songs that came out, maybe even Undercover, I don't know, then he raced off and wrote some more, you know, which is good. Healthy competition is not a bad thing. There's plenty of that in Midnight Oil.
Right.
And they went down pretty quickly too, Manfred, which is always nice because, you know, sometimes in the past we've really had to crowbar and nail the things to the floor to get them to work. Other times they're a bit quicker, but these ones were all pretty easy.
Well, for Undercover, lyrically, it starts off, you're describing you driving down this road, and I'm not going to pronounce it right. Why do you help me? Is it?
I'm going down the barrel road.
That's it. That's it.
Yeah.
And you're describing, I think, fires along it. So this was a real event.
Fires and fires on one side and autumn in a way on the other. It's like we get two kind of reds in Australia. We get bushfire red and we get autumn red.
Now, this bushfire red stuff seems to be quite more common in the last few years, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's incredible. I mean, you know, we've just finished touring over in your country, and we still can't believe that there are politicians and people who think that climate change is some kind of weird lefty hoax. You know, we had fires the like of which you've never seen in your life. I've never seen. I've grown up fighting bushfires. I mean, not as a professional firefighter, but we have volunteer bushfire fighting in Australia because there's so much bush. Yeah. And, you know, as a kid, I can remember sitting on the roof of our house, you know, with my dad and his mates, and they've got a few beers and just the garden hoses up there, you know, just keeping the fire at bay. But this thing was, we were past a Marvel movie, you know, it was just immense, massive. And I live outside of Sydney part of the time, and the valley that I live in, half of that valley got completely, I mean, just smashed to smithereens, smoke. And I mean, it's a hell of a thing. And it's because the ground had dried out so much, the temperature increases, even if it's only 0.5 of a degree or 1 degree centigrade, it still makes a massive difference to something like a fire, which then creates its own weather system, you know, and the clouds are like 5 miles up in the air, and you just have to sneeze and everything catches on fire, and there are millions and billions of native animals fleeing, and it was seriously unbelievable. It was like Armageddon.
We know the album opens with a track, Rising Seas, and that starts off the lyrics, "Every child, put down your toys and come inside to sleep. We have to look you in the eye and say we sold you cheap. Let's confess we did not act with serious urgency. So open up the floodgates to the rising seas." So here, you know, of course, that's a metaphor of open up the floodgates, but the rising seas is another thing that's going on environmentally. You've got the fires, seas are rising. You mentioned coming here and touring in the States, and people still thinking that it's some sort of lefty thing. Well, it seems to me more recently that these people who were once climate deniers will now admit that the climate is changing, but they still don't acknowledge the reasons that the climate is changing or want to accept any responsibility for that, and seem to be completely fine with whatever the environmental impacts are. And I don't know that these types will ever work towards halting the crisis. You were a politician for a number of years in Australia. How did you work with these types of people to get them to understand that their actions are, you know, contributing to the destruction of the world, of everyone, of everything?
Well, I think you've said it very eloquently, and I agree. It's an incredibly difficult question, for whether you're involved in politics in a practical way or whether you're just a citizen and you care about what's happening to your community, your kids, whatever it might be. And I think, unfortunately, the short answer now is that we have no choice. We can't try and persuade these people. In your political system, it's utterly compromised by the PAC fundraising for members of Congress. They get the money from the fossil fuel industries. The Republicans have got people like, you know, I don't know how to pronounce their name. I think it might be the Koch brothers and others, you know, these big multimillionaires.
Koch brothers.
Koch brothers, yeah, whose financial interests basically lie in ravaging the planet. And they are never going to, reason is never going to persuade these people at all. I don't think the same goes for progressive or centrist parties by any stretch, or social democrat parties, including your own Democrats and others. But I think that it's so urgent now, and the warning signs, and they're not warning signs anymore, they're actual things happening, that we have a moral duty to non-violently resist in every possible way. And I think it's good to see the end of Trump. I don't know whether DeSantis or Trump comes back. I think Biden needs to stiffen his spine a bit, with great respect to your president. It's great to see Boris Johnson, kicked out the door. Hopefully they get someone who's a bit more mindful. Bolsonaro might go as well. But the pollution of truth and the ascension of essentially resurgent fascism and nastiness has made this task a lot more difficult. But the stakes are so high. And you know, you were kind enough to quote the start of Rising Seas to your audience. And the truth is that, at least for us, we're baby boomers. You know, we grew up relatively peaceful time for us. Not the same for everyone. We'd be the first to acknowledge it, but relatively well off. And how can we look our kids in the eye, to what they're going to be dealing with? We've got to take some steps now. And that's why I really think things like Bill McGibbon, who's an American who writes, and some of your listeners might know about, I think he's got an organization called Third Act, which invites older Americans to get involved in the process. Fantastic. You know, I think some of the initiatives that are underway in your country and other places are really good. Just needs lots of people on board. It is an emergency, and it's all hands on deck.
So I guess what I want to ask, and you've been addressing this, but how does one keep hope in the face of suicidal obstinance? And I think you've been touching on some of the answers to that, but still, it just seems that more crazy and crazy to me. The heat keeps getting hotter, things keep drying out, fires keep raging, storms seem to be getting worse, and another cool track I want to.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Manfred. And I think the short answer is that you have to find it where you can. And sometimes you find it in your music, and then you roll your sleeves up and you go out, you go back into, the hard work of activism and lobbying and raising your voice and the like, because the stakes are too high not to. When you get lowered into the ground eventually, or however it's done, you want to feel like you've given it your best shot, even if it's been and I'm an optimist by nature, and some might, Australians know me as quite a sunny person, you know, quite positive, even though I've been strongly involved in environment issues and other issues over the years. And even I must admit to times of despair, particularly at the failure of political systems to firstly deal with the fossil fuel industry and transition across to renewables, which can be done. If it was a war, we would do it. You know, we would do it like we did in World War II. We would gear up, we'd have insulation, we'd have heat pumps, we'd have solar panels, we've had wind turbines, you know, we'd price carbon into the system, and it can be done. You know, if Elon Musk, who's this right-wing whatever, can build an electric car, you can run the country on renewable energy. There's no question about that. So, yeah, I do sometimes feel the despair. But I think that music has a role to play in it all because, yes, it might, some of the words might be strong from a Midnight Oil record, for example, and people maybe sometimes don't want to listen, but it's there. But it also works on an emotional level, doesn't it? So you've got to draw some sucker from the things that feed your heart, whether it's just being outside in a park or spending time with loved ones or listening to music that you like or celebrating a positive, and then go back out and take on the forces of darkness.
Another cool track I want to mention is At the Time of Writing on the new album Resist. And now that is a tune that drummer Rob Hurst came up with Jim. What were your thoughts when you were first presented with that one?
Well, I thought it was just a very on the money song that jumped onto the table. And Rob's got he's got an uncanny knack. It's a real gift for being able to distill a moment, you know, and sort of get the big thoughts and the big ideas into essentially a pop rock song, you know.
Yeah.
It's very strong, and it's interesting. We've been playing it a lot in the live set, and I can see people really responding to it.
Well, that one's got the line about old King Cole is dying. And of course, here, it's kind of an entendre there. The think of old King Cole, the nursery rhyme, but also specifically to Australia. Australia is a big coal producing nation, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think we've got some really difficult and serious work to do in our own country, and in particular around coal and gas. We sit in the top 10 of countries who essentially have plans for exploitation, in our case mainly of gas. The coal's already there,
yeah,
which means that we're producing carbon bombs. And these carbon bombs, which will go off in different countries, China, Saudi Arabia, Canada, Australia, Russia, and your own country, are enough to blow the 2-degree or even 1.5-degree limit of warming completely out of the water, just make Earth literally uninhabitable in 50 years' time. So, yeah, we've got some very big, very, very big campaigns to stick our heads into and to try and play a role in, which is what I expect we will continue to do even when we stop playing. I know I will. I'm sure I will be spending quite a bit of time specifically on that issue when I get back to Australia.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to go out now with another track off the new album, Resist, the cut Nobody's Child. And to me, at least, this one isn't as tied directly to our, let's say, our environmental woes as much as it's a vehicle to spread the message of, as you say in the song, beauty, love, and compassion. How do you see this song sitting in with the rest of the tunes on the album?
Well, I think we needed to say that somewhere because in some ways, you know, if you distill what the poets and the philosophers and the rappers, you know, the good rappers and others are saying, and, you know, what your grandmother said to you and, you know, someone who you admired as a teacher or whatever, it pretty much comes down to the same thing. I mean, that's not soft. That's actually a pretty hard message in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, Jim had this, he had the choruses, which are much more personal for him, but we needed to find a way of uplifting it and essentially presenting an overall thematic that maybe people could hold on to and find nourishing. So hence, you know, the verses there, which I wrote in. And then, of course, what you need Midnight Oil to do is just to play the thing, you know, like there's no tomorrow. And still find if that energy is there. Has it gone away? Is that conviction there? Yes, it is still there. What is it that we can actually do with this song? Well, we've just got to amp it, you know, and let it do it. Let the song do its business after that, hopefully.
And so you mentioned, I guess Jim came up initially with the tune, and then you contributed these extra lyrics, or.
Well, he had the choruses and part of the verse run, and then so the verses, and then part of the bridge musically, we did a bit of a finagle and threw a few other chords in and just got it sort of on its tracks, and then said to everybody, okay, play record.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Oh, man, it's been a great pleasure, and I'm absolutely chuffed that Undercover's cracked this beautiful little title on this great radio station. So great to talk to everybody, and all good wishes from my end, mate.
Well, now, off their album Resist, here's Midnight Oil with Nobody's Child and Little Steven's Underground Garage. That was some of Nobody's Child from Midnight Oil here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. The track is off their latest album, Resist. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to their lead singer and frontman, Peter Garrett, for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Next time around, my guest will be Robert Schneider from Apples in Stereo. He's led the group starting 1992. He's also been involved with all sorts of other music projects. And he's a professor of mathematics as well. We'll find out how all this adds up on our next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
When I came into this world now.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.